This is RSBNB Update, episode 651, The Lore of RuneScape. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for our RSBNB update. Merry Christmas to everyone listening to this episode, as we are only a couple days away from that if you're listening on the weekend, or it might be Christmas Eve or Christmas Day if you're listening a little bit later. But nonetheless, we have a bit of a departure from this week's regular RSBNB update that would have been scheduled because Jagex finished the year off with no big update 2 days before Christmas. And to commemorate that, Colton is back.
Thank you, Shane. Merry Christmas, everybody.
You remember last year, a couple days before Christmas, it was you, myself, and Sirion, and we were discussing Sliskay's endgame.
I was digging back through my old articles, and I noticed that that had been written about a year ago, and it was it's interesting because I feel like it's been in ways longer than a year and yet shorter than a year, but what a quest to end that year on and then to have
what was 20...
we won't delve on it. Yeah. Have relatively little.
And you know, you might be wondering why we're here and what we're going to be doing. You know, we talked and we could have done an overview of the year that was 2017 on RuneScape, but
would have been very short.
It would have been very short. And, you know, there were ways to look at it in a very positive and enlightening way. And you know, one of the things that people always say about me is that if I really want to, if Shane really wants to, he will find the positive in whatever is put out in front of him. And that's what we could have done with a RuneScape's best updates of 2017.
Find that silver lining.
But, you know, there's just so many things this year that we talked about that we released that, you know, in one way or another, hit the mark eventually. The best course of action would have been to just rehash the experiences and discussions we had on those episodes. And we decided, no, let's not do that. Let's do something new. Mm-hmm. So what Colton and I are going to do is we are going to do something that we have wanted to do for a very, very long time on this podcast, a very, very long time, and that is run through the lore of RuneScape from the very beginning to where we are today. Now, that could take forever if we did go and take an all-exhaustive approach, but we're not going to do that. It's going to be a very high-level overview, and we're going to get into the specifics in some parts of it. But before that, I will say that if you do want a little bit of an overview of RuneScape in 2017, you can head on over to RSBNB Informer at informer.rsbnb.com and read Tanis's great headlining article, RuneScape's Best Updates of 2017. And he goes through all of the updates, and there's some surprising ones near the top of the list that might shock you guys and surprise you guys with that. But nonetheless, that is a good summary of RuneScape in 2017. If you're looking for our critical analysis of it, go there, read that if you want that. You can pause the show. It's all right. Now we're going to talk about RuneScape lore. And you're the best person I know of right now at this point in this group of people that we know to talk about RuneScape lore, because you have been around for a good amount of time in
a reasonable
in-game.
Deal.
I think you started off with RS2. You didn't play RS Classic, right?
Yeah, I actually passed 10 years just around when the Gower Quest hit last year. So I'm a little over 11 years old in RuneScape right now. So
all right,
yep,
all right, fair enough. Well, we're going to start off, and we're going to start off with the very beginning. Now, this is something that isn't exactly in-game all that much. This is something that was really just first gone into detail on this year at RuneFest 2017, back in September, at the Lore Marathon talk. And even at the Lore Marathon talk, it was only about 10 or 15 minutes worth, but it was something very interesting, and it goes to the very beginning of how the world and the universe is set up and how that gives us where we're at right now.
Yeah. And they've been talking about this stuff for a while. They've, for at least 2 or 3 years, been kind of bandying about the idea of solidifying what exactly RuneScape's sort of planetary system is like, and how they all the planes interrelate. And only now did they really kind of sit down and codify that idea.
Yeah, and beyond. And that topic was RuneScape cosmology. And I'm just going to go through some of the bullet points here that came from that, and then we can kind of expand that out into how this leads us to the very beginning of the first age. So one of the things that we, I think, knew before is that there have been many revisions of the universe that contains Gilanor. And the elder gods who are in charge of this work in a cycle of creation and destruction. Now, there's going to be some spoilers ahead because obviously this deals with lore. I think we first got the sense of destruction in the Elder God quest that was predating Sliske's endgame, Heart of Stone, that the Elder Gods were up to something very nefarious, and specifically nefarious in the sense of destruction. And we've also learned since then that we must prove our worthiness to them, and that has been established in numerous Elder God-related quests. So the universe itself in RuneScape is a series of planes that contain one or more worlds and constellations, and these were all, of course, back in the day, created by the Elder Gods. And surrounding this is a periphery. And beyond that is just a void. They call it an infinite emptiness of the universe. So basically, the universe is infinite. And in between each of these planes that, Colton, you were just talking about, is the abyss. And of course, this is the abyss we have known for a long time. That's the abyss that we teleport through. And if you remember back in the day when RS2 came out, there was a random event where you could get stuck in the abyss and your teleport would malfunction and you would get refunded the runes.
So I thought this was really interesting because, I mean, and you mentioned we've known about the abyss for a long time. We didn't really understand exactly how it functioned. We knew that teleportation relied on passing through the abyss, but where exactly the abyss was in relation to other planes was kind of nebulous.
Yeah.
And they seemed to tie everything together really well, as though this was kind of the intention from the very beginning, which I think very clearly it was not. From the time that we first heard about the abyss, right, it didn't seem like this was even something that was in the scope of RuneScape. But
yeah,
they tied it together nicely, and it seemed to fit.
Because the abyss, as it was illustrated, is in effect the surrounding area of a honeycomb, and the cells of the honeycomb are the planes where things exist. And of course, Gilanor is in one of these planes. So it's kind of the same idea as wormhole theory in astrophysics, where you can puncture space between two areas to cross through it and move somewhere else. If you guys are looking for an earthly explanation with that. Now, there's numerous planes. All of the various planes were created by the Elder Gods. So they started off with the lower planes, and these included worlds like Frenisque, which was Gilanor of the previous revision, a balanced world. And we heard about that a lot in Fate of the Gods and Children of Ma. So, and, you know, it's interesting to see what Frenisque has become after that revision and cycle of destruction has began, because that kind of foreshadows what the early stages of destruction of Gilanor would look like if the Elder Gods were to carry through their plans for destroying the universe as it currently exists. Also in the lower planes, we have Infernus, Vampirium, and Leng. Infernus, of course, represents smoke. Vampirium represents blood. And Leng represents ice. And now you might be wondering, where does Shadow come in with this? Well, the reality is that Shadow appears from one reality to the next, and there are traces of it everywhere through all the planes. So Shadow is, in a way, kind of the force that ties all of these different worlds in the lower plane together.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take a step up further to the elemental planes, which is where the Elder Gods initially did their work. Now, the Elder Gods were initially known as, early on in the RuneScape Scratchpad, as Elemental Titans. And this is because each of the Elder Gods represented one of the elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And there was a struggle between all these to determine who would be the strongest. Jazz was the strongest, given by its representation in the Frenisgate Elder Halls as a six-sided shape. And Bic, of course, was the weakest, being represented by a triangle. Now, you know, since this is something that's in-game, did we actually notice this in-game before it was announced that this was a pecking order, so to speak, of the Elder Gods or the Elemental Titans?
I think there was at least some talk of that being a possibility. I don't know if it was completely a widely held opinion, but I think a lot of people just saw the individual shapes that were representing each Elder God as just sort of shapes to represent them, and not exactly. But I think at some point, We've heard so much about Jazz that it's hard not to think that Jazz is the most powerful.
Exactly.
I mean, the stone, before we really even knew who or what Jazz was, the stone has been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it's been influential in probably the most popular of RuneScape quest lines. And thus, it seems as though, at least in the consciousness of the RuneScape player base, that Jazz would be seen as a very powerful being to have created such a powerful artifact.
And, you know, back in the day when we had no idea what was going on the RuneScape 2 master header on the webpage, there was actually a Stone of Jazz there before we had too much lore about it in game. But stepping down further through the orders, we talked about Jazz being the most powerful, representing progression and air in terms of elemental. Next is Full, who represents fire and constancy. Then we have Water, represented by Wen, which is inversion. And finally, the lowest on the pecking order is Earth, represented by Bic, and alteration is its specialty. So combining all the Elder Gods, they realized, you know, that they could combine and collaborate to come up with the other combinations to create new and more important elements. So mist, steam, dust, lava, and so on and so forth. And this allowed the creation of the compounds that would create life, similar to how our periodic table of elements work, how you can combine various molecules and whatnot to get more complicated molecules, and that in effect forms humans, giant globs of carbon. And that's the same kind of thing that the Elder Gods do here. And then there's even higher orders of the planes here. And then we go up to the catalytic planes, and these were the Elder Gods' first attempts at creating actual worlds. So the primordial group of the catalytic planes includes body, law, chaos, and mind. Now, each of these were, of course, worked and represented by a specific Elder God. Body was Bic, and the world of Ocularis was created by Bic with the body energy. And we've heard of TerraGuard as well. That was an infusion of law energy. Jagex didn't specify, but there was no world created with pure chaotic energy, because I don't think that makes much sense. And now here's a big one, represented by Jazz and created by Jazz with mind energy, plus someone else, was Kefzi. Which we all know played a huge role in some of the storylines that we're going to be discussing going forward. And Jagex implied that each of the Elder Gods worked with someone else, not necessarily one of the four Elder Gods already mentioned, but they did work with someone else to create these worlds. And they didn't exactly reveal that in their talk at RuneFest. So that's something interesting to kind of keep in mind. And maybe someone will come up with a theory on that going forward. Then we have the higher material catalytic planes of nature, death, and blood. Nature, of course, focuses on the world of Nerrigan, which features prominently in the first age, which, of course, we'll get to in just a little bit. That was worked by Bick. Death was when, and blood was full. And there were... And it makes sense. There was really no worlds created with the energy of death and blood, because just like chaos, that wouldn't make sense now, would it? And then we have the transcendent planes, where the elder gods realize that if they indeed work together with some other element, they can create more complicated worlds. And the world of astral energy was called Hallow, and that was Jazz and Wen working together with some unknown factor. Cosmic energy was created with Jazz and Full, and soul energy was created with Jazz and Vic. And now, of course, you know what the key point there is with all the transcendent energy is that Jazz is heavily involved in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So the way Jagex wants us to think about these planes is that as you progress and move up through the planes, you essentially achieve a higher state of being, similar to the runes in RuneScape. And that's why some of the higher up ones, the transcendent planes, involve Jazz working with Wen and Bick creating these planes. So it's a very high energy plane. And, you know, I think at some point in the Elder God storylines going forward, we will learn more about these. And we did learn about Terragard and Kethsi, obviously, and Nerrigan a bit, but not too much. So this is going back to the very basics and the foundations of the RuneScape universe. Then finally, you have the plane where everything is in balance. And that is, of course, where Gilanor exists. It has been called the perfect world, balance of elements, essence of runic magic, has its cradle of life, the purest form of anima, and as Jagex calls it, delicious, or as represented by Brassica Prime, pure deliciousness. which they did say that, you know, Brassica started off as a joke, but was worked into canon because of this. So
they leaned into it real good.
Yeah. And then there are a few pocket universes as well that involve the rune altars and bringing certain elements from those worlds in tune with ours through these pocket universes at the rune altars. There's also the rune span, which accomplishes that, and the spirit plane from the numerous spirit plane quests as well. So that's how the universe works. And the important thing to remember is that the Elder Gods created all of this. And we know from Heart of Stone and subsequent Elder God quests that we are nearing a cycle of destruction. And eventually, at some point, all of this could be wiped away. And it kind of underscores what we saw at the end of Sliski's endgame when we tried to talk to Jazz. And Jazz wasn't having any of that at all, because we identified ourselves as the World Guardian, and Jazz is like, who is that? I don't care about that. In the grand scheme of things, as you can see here, we are very pitiful. So that is how the universe of RuneScape works and how we get to Gilanor, a perfect plane of balance created with all the Elder Gods working together, and a balance of all the elements from the pure worlds that they created. So you can't be too pure. You have to achieve harmonious balance. And that takes us nicely into the first age of Gilanor as we know it.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is we really don't know. The first age really begins with Guthix.
Guthix discovering Gilanor.
Yeah. I mean, primarily we have knowledge of things before that with Sferidomen's ascendants and things like that, and happenings somewhat vague on other planes before this, but time really doesn't begin in terms of how RuneScape's ages have fallen until Guthix does ascend and find Gilanor. I mean, he ascends. I think we all have mostly heard the story mostly through The World Wakes and lore connected to that quest especially, which revealed that his homeworld had been kind of taken over. Well, Sferidomen came first, and he screwed things up. And then, oh goodness, and now I'm forgetting the name of...
I'm not sure something, who you're going for.
Skargaroth. There it is, I think. Skargaroth. Right?
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
Comes, and there's a fight between Skargaroth and Tuska. Skargaroth, I believe, falls on Guthix's house, kills his daughter, Guthix comes out, takes Gargaroth's sword, takes the remaining eyes out of Tuska, and then kills Skargaroth. And in killing Skargaroth with this sword, which I think has been called the Rift Sword before, it's an Elder artifact, Skargaroth's sword was, and he uses it to kill Skargaroth, and in doing so creates the connection that we see time and time again between a mortal being and a god being, and thus in killing him channels the energy into Guthix and he ascends.
And we have to remember that this was a huge event because he didn't ascend, mm-hmm. you know, just a demigod or a mid-tier no. god. He went almost to the top, as high as you could go with that.
Well, and it helped the fact that he was able to find for himself three other artifacts as well. He encountered the Staff of Armadil, the Stone of Jazz, as well as the Elder Horn. And so he, at one point, had four Elder artifacts. And so he was kind of loaded up, and he traveled through various planes gradually and consistently growing more and more powerful, and eventually did happen upon Gilenor, and where he kind of saw this perfect world, decided that it would be nice to share this with some other people, and he goes back to the Elven homeworld with Saren there, and decides to bring them over, as well as some other creatures, namely humans from Terrigard and some others, decide to come through via the World Gate. Guthix continues to enjoy his kind of created world here, and he decides to impart magic to the humans that have been taken over and the other beings that have been brought to Gilenor, and he imbues the runestones to allow the Gilenorian inhabitants to access magic. This is later forgotten, which we'll get to. But soon after, as we see once again, time and time again, Guthix begins to be the item of worship, which
he did
was
not
never
like.
His intention.
He did not like.
I mean, that seems to be pretty consistent with Guthix's whole steez, is that he really didn't even want to be a god in the first place. He was just frustrated because his things were kind of sucky, and he was mad, and so he defended himself in what way he saw possible, and in doing so became an extremely powerful god, and just so happened to discover and happen upon the perfect world and brought people to it. And so to stop people worshiping him, he burrows down into the ground very deep and goes to sleep for a little while, even, and he's left the gate open. Yeah. For quite a while, actually, through this whole of the second age until the end of the
Something
third
like
age.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And we'll get to that.
Yeah. But, and you know,
yeah, that's how the first age ends.
I think the first in-game evidence of this was the meeting history quest. And, mm-hmm. you know, you told me when we were putting the show together, you said put through any quests that had to be mentioned here. And the first one that immediately jumped to mind was meeting history.
Same.
That quest, you know, it just appeared so innocuous at the time, but it was a major quest in determining how the world works and what things were like in the first age, which, you don't hear of all that often. Mm-hmm. And
you meet human colonists who've come from Terrigard, and you are introduced to the fact that runestones have been distributed and are being dispersed, and you're taught the mage. I can't remember the actual one who's been walking around and giving and kind of evangelizing for the sake of magic. But anyhow, you learn about that, and it's an early quest, but it teaches a lot. We don't know that much about the first age, but it teaches us a lot and very early on.
You know, I was thinking when we were doing this that if Jagex ever wanted to and they wanted to produce another video game about RuneScape, they need to set it in the first age.
He's sort of trying to think like a vampire, no, civilization maybe?
Yeah, something like that. like, I mean, it could even have hints of the same MMO to it, but just... You know, it's just so different considering that magic has just been discovered. Like, what would that be like? So,
yeah, for sure.
So I guess it's fair to say then that the first age ends with people discovering magic, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Discovering magic and Gothics falling asleep.
Right. All right. So what does that give us for age two?
Age two kind of gradually begins after Gothics has gone to sleep, as the world gate remains to be open. And so other gods, of course, with the world gate open, discover
and
Gilinor.
To be clear,
they
is
arrive.
This is the same world gate that we still use today, right?
Yes, yes. Reopened by us, the world guardian in the sixth age. So, and so the gods, namely, I mean, we'll a lot come through, but we'll kind of narrow it down to the big ones who come through and bring their followers. Oh, and just an aside, I totally forgot. Gothics tried to tell Saren to leave at the end of the first age, and she kind of agreed, but then she basically said she didn't. She stayed with her elves because she felt it so
hard. Yeah, we know what
happened
there.
Yes.
Now, did she shatter herself at the end of the first, or was that later?
No, that's when the edicts are put in place.
Oh,
we'll get
right
to that.
Okay.
Yeah. So the second age is characterized kind of as the age of the gods rising. Third age is also an age of the gods, but of a different sort. And so Sarah Doman arrives on the scene, and he mainly takes over the area that we now know as most of Mauritania, the Mire Ditch area primarily, as well as he gets a grip on the island of Entrana, which of course still remains heavily Sarah Dominist to this day. Bandos comes through, bringing, of course, his lovely goblin-y races with him, and they take some unknown plots of land, whatever wasn't claimed. We don't really have any significant evidence of where they settled. Armadil have the areas, the kind of sky citadels, like the clans, what we know as the clan citadels now.
Right.
And also a significant portion of Kandarin. And then the Manaphite Pantheon, which I've written a few Informer articles on. you'll find that I've written.
Some nice lore recaps right before Menaphos came out, if I recall.
Yes, that was the intent, to kind of review exactly who was involved in the Manaphite Pantheon and what they did. They settled in what is now the Caridian Desert, and it was a very large establishment. The Second Age was big for the Menaphite Pantheon, particularly Tumakin, connected with the demigods, and Ikflaren and Amasket. We'll talk about them in a moment. And also Zaros, of course, comes through and probably is the second biggest influence in this age, at least at the very beginning of the age and throughout most of the age.
Now, I guess this is the point where we can say it would start to get hairy when Zaros arrives.
Yes. Zaros begins to create an empire. He has Farinthri, which is basically the whole of the wilderness, which was, of course, not wilderness at that point and was quite abundant. The northern area of Mauritania, the northern area of Mistelin, and Asgarnia as well. So he's taken a large swath of the map, in fact, probably the largest empire by a factor of at least a couple, was the Zerosian Empire. But it was not founded just upon Zaros. Zaros was smart and was for a long time engaged in the Caridian-Zerosian War with the Menaphite Pantheon, namely the forces led by Tumakin and Ikflaren and Amasket. And so to help kind of turn the tide for the Caridians, the gods, demigods, Ikflaren and Amasket went to Franiske. And again, I have some articles on this. They go to Franiske and they talk to the Majarat and basically convince them, long story short, to come to Gilinor and to fight for them. And so they do. And for quite a long time, the Majarat are used to the success of the Menaphites, and they defeat the Zerosians quite summarily for quite a long time. But there comes a point where Sliske and a few others decide to turn on the Menaphites and, again, making a kind of a long and lore-rich section a bit short, they instead ally themselves with the Zerosians and eventually push the Caridians back. And Tumakin goes boom, and the desert happens. Well, I mean, summarily, that is kind of what happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great way of describing it.
And as sort of his last act of defending.
Yeah. And, you know, for anyone wondering, this is the classic desert arc, Temple at Sentistan dig site, kind of desert treasure quest lines that shadow in on this era in RuneScape. And, you know, we are also getting with the Clue Scroll rework in 2018, Second Age armor, which looks really astounding. Kind of highlights, I think, the progress that was made with the Second Age as well. So... really neat.
I'm going to be honest with you. I haven't seen this stuff.
Yeah.
This is going to be weird if it looks a lot more better than the Third Age armor. You get what I mean?
Let me grab you a picture kind of, like, of this because they actually featured this quite well on the live streams when they were talking about the Clue Scroll rework. I know we have a huge, selection of it when we were doing that podcast, but it looks simple, but it's not overdone in my opinion. I don't know, that's the armor for the various three classes right there. I don't know, you can see what you think of that.
No, I like that.
You think that fits in well with the Second Age?
I mean, part of me wants them to revamp Third Age equipment to make it look better because I don't think it serves the Third Age justice, but you know, I think the Second Age armor looks great, and I will certainly be seeking it out for myself.
Yeah, it's going to be in the new master tier of Clue Scroll.
I'm excited for that. Yeah. Very excited. I love Clue Scrolls.
Yeah, and I want to say I think they said they were going to do something with Second Age lore with this, but I'm not entirely certain that that was the case. That might have been wishful hearing on my part, but fingers
crossed. It'd be nice if we could get some more on that. I mean, we know a good deal on the Second Age, but it'd still be neat to get some new perspectives because most of what we know is from Zaras and
right, and that could very well be a biased source with that. Mm-hmm. So
for sure.
Let's see. Yeah. Ritual of the Majorat also touches on this because after the Majorat arrived, there would be rituals of rejuvenation every few years as well.
Yeah, and in that quest, we really it's highlighted the kind of divide between Zamorakian and Zerosian Majorat, which is, of course, begun by the fact that once the Majorat were incorporated into the Zerosian Empire, they began to feel as though, even though they were very high up, and especially Azanadra, Zamorak, and Sliske were given extremely high positions in the Zerosian Empire, they felt that once they had conquered, there was really nothing else to do, and they felt as though they were going stagnant, because the Majorat, it seems, thrive upon a very war-driven culture. I mean, every so many years, they have to kill one of their own in order to survive. It's a very hardened people. And thus Zamorak and a few others, Zamorak namely, of course, decided to revolt against Zaros, and Zamorak got the staff somehow from a guy who basically stole it, a human whom he traded, just gave him some money, I guess, for this super duper very powerful god making staff and god killing staff. And at some point along the way, he also got into the possession of the Stone of Jazz. We don't really know how. That's never really told. But we know he does come into contact with it. And thus, Zamorak grows significantly in power. And he's also able to do a lot of this because he has changed. Zaros has kind of a journal master who follows Zamorak and other generals along on their journeys. And his journal is magically connected to Zaros in that it basically copies whatever he writes and sends it directly to Zaros so he knows what's going on during the missions. But Zamorak twice alters this the spell upon his journal. And the first spell is just to basically copy it another time, basically carbon copying it to Zamorak, in that he will also get the copy of this. So he knows what this guy is writing. But then he also alters it again to change what it says when it is sent to Zaros, in order to kind of mask his plans and to prevent Zaros from knowing that Zamorak is planning a revolt. But anyhow, to make a long story short, he marches on Santistan, and after a bit of a scuffle between Zaros and he, even though Zaros seems to have the upper hand after getting stabbed once, there is a connection point when Zaros and Zamorak are both stabbed by the staff by two ends. Zaros is basically impaled upon it. And in being impaled, once again, we see travel powering, passing through the staff and powering up Zamorak even more than he had been with just the stone. And after he's done this, he kind of comes back. He declares himself a god, but is cursed. But it is kind of cursed by the other gods. They don't see his ascension as not only honorable, but legitimate.
Right.
And so they banish him from the realm. And so he goes away. Zaros.
And we saw part of this in a cutscene in a quest, but we didn't actually see the stab happen.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I feel like we saw the double stab happen in Children of
I think it was Children of Ma, or it was either back. The event that preceded Children of Ma.
Because before Children of Ma, the quest right before it was Fate of the Gods, because Children of Ma was Fate of the Gods too.
Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember.
I think it has to have been in Children of Ma, because they wouldn't put that in a standalone game event.
Because that's the quest in which we go back with, I believe, oh, crud. The Fremnik Majorat, the guy who stays neutral, Karshai.
Right.
Goodness, it's taking me a few seconds to get these guys' names up. But Karshai, we go through kind of his recollections of how the betrayal kind of went down. And we go through the temple and look at the signs of the revolt and all that. But yeah, so Zaros is defeated, at least seemingly. He flees his mortal body, and thus, is an incorporeal form and goes to other realms and goes around in this realm. And, as he leaves, he, curses those who rebelled against him, and, the mortals, the humans, at least for the most part, quickly die off. We see that with Gora and a few others. And so Zamorak has been banished, and, that's kind of, we don't really have
it's no proper ending for the second age, right?
Yeah. There's not a clean opening or really ending for the second age. We just know that the third age really begins with the God Wars, which we'll get to here in a minute. There's kind of a nebulous ending, but it ends around.
And
there.
I think to anyone who would have seen Zaros at the time, do you think that they assumed he was dead, or do you think they knew that he just disappeared on his own?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, we see from a lot of people that most assume that he's dead, for the most part. But there are certainly few who hold to the belief that he is still alive. I mean, Azanadra is still trying to summon him in the fifth age when we bring him out of the temple, or the pyramid, rather, and he's in the temple at Santistan, and he's trying to bring Zaros back. He knows that he's there. So his most loyal followers still do believe he's there, but some of the less ones, most of them, in fact, kind of abandon the idea, and the Zarosian Empire slowly fades and is built over and destroyed. We'll see that in the Third Age, for sure. A lot of this stuff, and it's not a quest, and a lot of people hated it because of how grindy it was. And I get that. I get that. This was not two or three years ago. I want to say 3 years. Majorat Memories. Absolutely amazing mini quest.
It was the ramp up to Fate of the Gods, I think.
Yes, because we had to charge up the Ingrameter.
Yes, that's it.
Correct. Okay, so it was. So, yeah, I'd say that's around 3 years ago. But anyhow, point of the story is that the books that are gained from the memories in this mini quest are absolutely rich with lore from the Second Age primarily, because you get each Majorat's perspective on what was going on, and you learn so much about their position in the Zerosian Empire and how the betrayal occurred. Of course, we learn more as we actually go through Fate of the Gods and Children of Ma, but at that point, at least for me, that was probably like my favorite event of just being able to sit and read through like 12 books or however many it was. It was a ton of lore that was just dropped at once.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right, it did feel grindy at the time, but in hindsight, that was probably one of the best lore updates they did going into a quest.
I would agree.
So, and I think we all have access to that at the end of the day still, if we wanted to read that off our bookshelf, right?
Yeah, no, and I think if you haven't done it, of course, you can still do it. It just takes access to divination.
Right,
And the ability to go around and do that. You know, I highly recommend it. And if you haven't actually read those, if you were kind of at that point wanting to just get it done, check it off for your comp tape or whatever, I would highly advise that you go back and just take some time to read through at least a few of them, because the info on Sliske gave us such an interesting look into Sliske before we really got a more solidified idea of his character through the endgame storyline. So it was awesome.
Well, that could be a nice winter project for anyone, anyone who hasn't done that yet, though I'd imagine a good portion of the people who have done all the quests will have done that. And that was an actual quest requirement for Fate of the Gods, was it not?
Really? I think it was advised, because the Ingrameter helped in some ways protecting you on Frenisque, I'm pretty sure.
Let's see.
I don't think it was required. Maybe it was. I can't remember. I'd already done it, so it was never of too much concern.
Yeah, okay. Recommended fully charged Ingrameter after Majorat memories. So.
Gotcha.
All right. So you said there's no proper closeout for the Second Age. It all comes down to opening the Third Age with something, right?
Yeah. What we really know is that the Third Age, for the most part, begins after, because Zamorak was gone for about 20 or so years, and he comes back with an army that he has accrued from, I mean, Infernus and other realms of vampires and all sorts of creatures, demons namely. And he's brought them back to basically reclaim the stone, because once Zamorak was banished that first time, Ceridoman took the stone and is now in possession of it. And of course, Zamorak wants that back. More power is good. And so he comes back, and the God Wars are triggered. During all of this, we kind of, as a side note, we have the Zerosian extermination going on, which basically is where, as we mentioned, the Zerosian Empire kind of crumbles. Sentison is finally taken, destroyed, becomes the city known as Seranthium, which is basically a Ceridomenus city built on that site. As an Adra is finally captured and is imprisoned in the pyramid of terrible pronunciation, Yaldryakt.
I'd say that's a pretty good pronunciation right there.
That's what I'm going to go with. So, yeah, the Zerosians pretty much are put away. The less dedicated ones fade to the background, and the kind of four-god structure begins to really emerge in this age. This is the age of the God Wars. And so the God Wars are it's all power struggle, really, between the four sides that we all should mostly know of, Zamorak, Ceridoman, Bandos, and Armadyl. Ceridoman, Bandos, and Armadyl, for the most part, at least for the first couple, I think, 1,000 years of the Third Age, were all allied and were at least loosely in a singular goal of ousting Zamorak, as he had a significant force. And it looked as though if they weren't united, he would steamroll everyone. And so one of the biggest, and to kind of just highlight some big battles that occurred throughout the God Wars, very early on, we had Nex imprisoned below the temple. It was the battle for the ritual site. It was kind of the last of the Zerosians really fighting to keep what we've seen that in Ritual of the Maazrat and a few other quests here. It was a very important site for not only the Zerosian Maazrat, but for Maazrat in general. And it was set up by Zaros here on Gildenor. And so Nex and other forces try and keep it, but eventually they are pushed back and Nex is put into an icy prison. And on top of it is built the Temple of the Lost Ancients, which is basically left for a few thousand years until later when the Battle of the Godsword really kicks off, that that actually comes into play.
So what is the Temple of the Lost Ancients today? Where would that be?
That's the God Wars.
Okay.
That's the God Wars dungeon. So Nex's prison in this case was the prison we know of now with the Frozen Key and all that whole deal.
All right.
So later, much, much later on, we have still the alliance of Ceridoman, Bandos, and Armadyl attempting to finally kill Zamorak, as Zamorak has been pushed, and it seems as though they might finally defeat him, and so they decide that they're going to forge the God Sword. Except we see this, I believe, in a cutscene at some point. I think it's during Wild Gothic Sleeps. Maybe it's not. Anyhow, that Armadyl, the Aviantes are tasked with transporting the forged Godsword over to the front so that Ceridoman can kill Zamorak with the Godsword. But Zamorak has intercepted the plans for the transportation and thus intercepts the Godsword. Or at least tries to intercept the Godsword. He doesn't successfully do it. What happens is that the Aviantes flee the Zamorakian forces that are harrying them and basically hole up in the Temple of the Lost Ancients. And Ceridomanist and Bandosian forces end up joining them, and it initially is a concerted effort against the Zamorakian forces to not only get the Godsword, but to kill Zamorak. But eventually the tensions rise to a point where the tripartite alliance dissolves, and it just basically becomes an all-out battle for the Godsword and to kill each other.
So and that's, of course, kind of we see the minions, of course, still fighting down there in the God Wars dungeon. And
yes, and we see that because, well, at some point, Nex is freed by Sliske, actually, and then she's re-imprisoned. But then later, I believe toward the end of the Third Age, guy named by the name of Magus Aeternum actually casts a very strong spell of freezing on the Temple of Lost Ancients, the God Wars dungeon, and thus they are kind of frozen in this state of perpetual battle for all eternity to be rediscovered in the Fifth Age. So, and all during, just to kind of go back, there are a few other really big storylines throughout the quote-unquote God Wars. Even though when we think God Wars, we think the Temple of the Lost Ancients, there's more going on. I mean, the Temple of the Lost Ancients really was only the end of it, primarily, and the beginning of it. But throughout the entire time, the Caridian Desert is being harried by both Zamorakian and Ceridomanist forces. They're mostly going for resources. But this does a huge number. Not only did the Menaphite people get hit pretty hard when the Maazrat turned and ended up obviously having Tumakin had to basically blow himself up. But now this fighting for their land really, really hurts their ability to grow. I mean, it was one of the earliest and largest human settlements, and it is being slowly kind of sucked dry, in a sense.
And also in some ways that makes sense, because that is the Caribbean desert dry. So mm-hmm. It's a good way of getting it across from Jagex's point of view.
Yeah, for sure. And we don't really even see these people until obviously the Sixth Age. But and then another big one is the fall of Hallowvale, which is that initially Iceene controlled Sarah Dominist area, Hallowvale with
with the vampires.
Remember the capital's name. Well, it becomes vampires. Lord Drakon and his host of vampires eventually take over and push the Iceene out. It's capped off when King Acertes is captured, taken captive, and Queen Aferite has to surrender. And eventually this leads to most of Mauritania becoming Mauritania and being overcome by vampire forces, Zamorakian forces. So
yeah, that's what happens with that. See, this isn't something people normally link. They don't normally link Meyerditch and the Hallowvale area and Mauritania, all of that, to the Third Age and the God Wars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was one of the very – I think it was in the middle of that quest line that we actually learned that it was Iceene territory beforehand. And that was a huge revelation at the time, because we didn't know exactly what was going on there in the very beginning when we were building out the storylines.
Oh, for sure. I mean, what we saw from the very beginning of RuneScape is just this really dirty, dark area that seems like it's never had any light in it. And yet we learned that it was previously heavily Sarah Dominist and ruled by, at least in many people's opinions, one of the neatest races that there are. Even if you don't like Sarah Dominist, the Iceene are pretty cool. And it just seems strange to imagine this being a Sarah Dominist stronghold at one point, and then we learn that it's been overtaken. And this, of course, leads to the very smartly named Mauritania campaign. It's the Barrows brothers. The six of them are given skills. These are Westerners, I believe, from across the South, and they want to take back what was theirs. They're Sarah Dominus. And so Sliske gives the brothers their armor and their weapons, and basically gives them the strength to make it all the way to not just Meyerditch, but to
Castle Draken?
Yeah, Castle Drakon and the area surrounding it. The name of which escapes me.
Sangesti region, I guess, is what it used to be.
Sangesti.
That's what we see on the map now, but I don't know if it would have been called that back in
Dark
the day.
Darkmire. 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 All right. Yes. I don't know why I didn't write that name down. They make it all the way to the walls of Darkmire, but then at that point, Sliske decides, you know what? You've fought long enough, and now you're going to die, and you're going to serve me, because you are now my whites. And so they've made it, and the campaign was actually going very well. The Sarah Dominus were destroying a lot of Drakon's forces. It was heavy losses for Drakon up until the Barrows brothers were killed and made whites right at the walls of Darkmire. And so the campaign ultimately failed.
Why would Sliske do such a thing?
Because he likes to screw with stuff, and he got some very powerful and very neat brothers, the Barrett Super Barrio brothers, to do his bidding. I don't know. He just likes to do stuff.
And just think of the alternate history that could have happened if they had been allowed to continue fighting there.
Well, and what's interesting is when he does bring them into subjugation, Sliske alludes to the idea that they will rise in service of his god. Which at least in that context makes it seem as though he's talking about Zaros when he returns, because he's talking about when his god returns.
Right, and we did see a bit of that in Kindred Spirits.
Yeah, but a lot of, I mean, Sliske dies, spoiler alerts, before we really, he's not really a Zarosian. And so it seems to, I wonder if this was just lore that never really, because this was obviously before, before we really had the Sisuke's endgame storyline and the sixth stage inaugurated. But yeah, Sisuke's operations here at least were to cause strife and discord among different factions that he just saw fit to sow discord within. So kind of toward to finish off the age, really, although the forces keep pushing one way and the other, Zamorak is eventually cornered in Ferinthrie, which is still all green and pretty, as it was when it was under Zerosian control.
That's something he is in possession.
Oh, I mean, we kind of see a little bit of it. We have a cutscene. It's actually a really neat cutscene. I believe it's in Dishonor Among Thieves, where we actually see Zamorak in this exact situation, where he is cornered by the three gods, and he's just kind of back against
I'll
the
have
wall.
I have to have a look at that then, because I know I have the playthrough somewhere, so I don't remember that one. All right.
Yeah, it's located in what will be the wilderness, and he basically as a last-ditch attempt, kind of like Tumakan does, except he doesn't destroy himself. He uses the stone to basically cause another big boom and absolutely desecrates the wilderness, or Ferinthrie, to make it the wilderness. It's ashen, and such destruction causes a shift in the force. We're also...
In Star Wars now?
In the balance, I don't know. I'm not a big Star Wars fan.
Good.
in the balance of things, I guess it were more appropriately, because Guthix reawakes. We're also told that there are some druids, a group of four, that are doing some sort of ritual to attempt to wake him up, which either that works or... the destruction of the Ferinthrie wakes him up. Something causes Guthix to reawake.
There were fairly destructive events before. I don't know if it would be just the destruction of Ferinthrie that would do it.
Nothing on the level of taking basically a quarter of the map and turning it to complete ash. I mean, given the destruction of the desert with what become the desert in with Tumakan. Shattering himself. That's debatable. So regardless, Guthix ends up awake again, first time since the end of the first age, and sees all that's been done and decides to put down a big old sword in what is now the Wilderness Volcano. It's the Edicts of Guthix. And all the other gods are banished from the realm. And so Guardians of Guthix are implemented and everything like that, and everyone else has to leave. And the one that really had trouble leaving at the very beginning in the first age and still has trouble leaving now decides that she will shatter herself into many, many little bitty pieces. And so Saren is shattered at the end of the third age. And thus, Guthix goes back to sleep. And thus ends the third age.
And leaves all the minions and all the people on Gilinar to clean up the mess that the gods have made.
Yes. Yeah, there's a big mess that, I mean, the fourth age we get to is characterized by the Age of the Mortals, because it's basically, at least for 1,000 years of it, mortals kind of recovering from the destruction that was wrought by the God Wars, because it tore up settlements. And basically what had happened is that... most humans who were not allied with certain factions abandoned the practice of creating large established settlements because they would just be destroyed. And so it kind of descended into sort of a barbarian tribal warfare type structure. And it took a while for societies and cities to really be built again. And we will see that in the fourth age, though.
All right. So I'd say that's a pretty good recap of the third age. And, you know, based on what we've seen in the past, the third age so far has been the most action packed with everyone around. And, you know, it seems that that is the one point in RS history that everyone would choose as, you know, a major inflection point as mm-hmm. to when everything changed, aside from what, you know, could be a very destructive sixth age too, but probably yeah. not. So
of the first ages, for sure, the third age was one of the biggest that we really learned about first, because the God Wars being introduced in 2007 introduced a lot of, I don't know if it was, again, intended to be the explanation of so much lore, but it was a central kind of figure in yeah. the Third Age yeah. and became the explanation for much of
and,
that.
You know, as much as the Third Age governs the lore of RuneScape and the changes that were made, when explaining the Third Age in lore, Jagex has done a really good job of, you know, taking the game from what is just a game to something that has a true level of understanding and reason behind it, and a path from the very beginning to where we are now, which is something you don't see in a lot of game worlds.
Yeah, for sure.
So, all right, Fourth Age, what do we got?
Well, at the very beginning, the poor little gnomes who have been hiding underground because of the God Wars and all the destruction that has been wrought, they come up, and of course, everything they made has been destroyed, much like just about everybody else. And so they eventually come to plant the Grand Tree, and the Grand Tree seedlings become what they are, and we get to see the beginning of the Gnome Society as we know it today. And this is just for the Fourth Age. We're just going to kind of run through because the elves or all the different races kind of do their own thing. And this isn't necessarily sequential, but it kind of is just what came to my mind. Dragonkin, eventually in the Fourth Age, really come onto the scene. And we see Robert the Strong push them back. Will eventually be Bob the Cat, as we learn in the Tale for Two Cats. Or A Tale of Two Cats.
Oh,
it's a great quest.
Yes, it is. It is a great quest and something. And once again, here's a thing that could have just been a stray cat wandering RuneScape, named after the cat that was by the Jagex offices, turned into a central lore figure.
Yep. And then we learn about him again in the Iluyanka quest, the name of which, once again, escapes me because we actually enter his library to read some lore tomes that he has. But then we continue again. Humans gradually begin to reestablish the practice of opening up established settlements. Avaraka, well, Falador is actually the first one to be built, but it is implied at least at some point that it is torn down and then rebuilt, kind of in the middle of the Fourth Age. But Avaraka, which would become Varrok, is founded primarily on a hero known as Arav.
And they grow considerably. Play a big role.
Mm-hmm. And so they begin to fight with him other tribes around them, because again, it's a tribal warfare kind of thing. We see that with like the barbarian village around. They're kind of the holdouts. And they grow in power, much as some of the Gothic tribes did in the Germanic region in our world. But they grow in power, and they form what would eventually be the Kingdom of Mystalin, even though they call it the Kingdom, very a loose confederacy at the beginning, but eventually solidifies more and more. And eventually the name is changed to Varrok. We don't really know why or what event triggers the changing of that name from Avaraka to Varrok. Something it might be because they changed their method of government or some celebratory measure. But anyhow, it becomes Varrok, and the Kingdom of Mystalin becomes more powerful. Lumbridge is also founded, as well as Alcarid at around the same time. And then a little after that, again, Falador as V2 is built.
It's starting to look like the world we know.
Yes, quite. And then we get what is touched on primarily by the Elf Quest series. We see that the elves without Saren begin to venture outside the area of Tirannan and make their way actually to control quite large areas of Kandaran, and continually moving east. In fact, Vaxdorian, and he's a leader of the Qadarn clan, they settle in that kind of area and begin an elf settlement there. And while they are away, we have the Yorwerth clan who have begun worshiping the Dark Lord, quote-unquote, the kind of dark side of Saren. And they, seizing the opportunity, because they've been left to basically look after Krithinis and those who did not go off to conquer and to... They weren't really conquering necessarily, but they were kind of spreading, as it were.
Basically a departure from standard elven ways, let's say.
Yes. They seize the opportunity and take the city. The act is called the Siege of Krithinis because what happens is Vaxdorian ends up hearing about the Orworth having taken the city. And so he goes back, tries to take it, but can't. And then essentially it ends in Vaxdorian, in a last-ditch effort, saving the elders of the clans from the city. And these elders then sing the city back into its crystal form. And the city is barred from any race, including the elves, until it is regrown in the sixth age.
And this is a really amazing thing because, you know, the elf storyline in RS is something that, you know, was one of the central storylines and everyone wanted to see it finished. But in the grand scheme of things, it's only an age old what happened there.
It's pretty new stuff. I mean, we do know that obviously Saren is one of the initial and kind of founding deities of Gilenor and was very crucial to the elves and their civilization was one of the oldest to be present. But the fact that the actual conflict that prevented us from getting in was actually not that old. And in terms of the grand scheme of history was kind of, not to say it was a blip on the radar, but it kind of was.
It was. That's right.
So... other happenings of the age, the dwarves remain underground during much of this age as they have remained underground for quite a long time. They construct the beautiful city of Keldegrim and the consortium is put into power. Belrak of the Majorat begins to delve deeper and deeper into Daemonheim and they start messing with portals and all that fun stuff, which is explored by, I don't know if you can call them mini quests, but the stuff with Moya. The adventures in which I can't remember exactly what the name is, but Thok is in some of them, the kind of dungeoneering
Fremenic Sagas
quests. There you go. Fremenic Sagas. And that's kind of explored there. At the same time, the vampires and the other races in Mauritania are completely basically overrunning the area before they begin to attack Myssalon. And once they begin to attack Myssalon, the seven priestly warriors that we really hear about in the Myarchy series push back the forces that have crossed the south and eventually bless the south such that these creatures will not be able to cross, which is obviously very central to the idea of the Myarchy series and much of the fifth age in general, which will get to here in a bit.
And we saw the ending of that, of course, in the finale for that quest line not too long ago. River of Blood in the grand scheme of things. And you know, there was a lore question with that one that we had some time ago on the podcast. Would the edicts have affected the salve at all? Coming down to the edicts.
You mean, would the edicts themselves have an impact on the blessing of
right.
the south?
Yeah.
I don't believe so. I don't see why it would.
Right, okay.
Because it is not a god in of itself.
Okay.
It has been introduced by Ceridominus, but it's not exactly...
The question was that, you know, the edicts are gone right now in the sixth age. Uh-huh. So what's to prevent something like that from happening now? And did the coming down of the edicts in the sixth age have an effect on the salve?
I would
probably
say no.
Not though.
Yeah.
Because I think we tested that in that final Vampire Quest, River of Blood.
I think that quest actually takes place in the Fifth Age, though, to my knowledge.
You're right.
At the very least, right. The second to last one takes place in the Fifth Age.
Yeah, definitely.
I know that. But regardless, I would say that it wouldn't. I could very much be wrong. I don't know 100% because I don't know exactly the nature.
River of Blood is indeed Fifth Age, so the edicts are in place. So that question is moot. That was really our first experience with that, and it was purely hypothetical.
Okay. Well, okay. Still delving into Mauritania, just a quick thing. Phasmites, during kind of the latter part of the Fourth Age, once the salve has been blessed, the seventh place, the warriors have pushed them back, the Mauritanian, the Zamorakian forces really begin to kind of retreat a bit. And the inhabitants of Mislin begin to think that the northern area of Mauritania is going to be safe to settle in. And so they do. Quickly, that becomes something they will regret, as obviously the residents of Canifis become werewolves. And those in Port Phasmites are freed and saved by their hero Necrovaris from the vampire overlords, but with a cost, they become his ghost slaves. Hooray.
Changing one bad thing for another.
Yeah, essentially, we get to see that quite in detail in Ghosts Ahoy, I believe the quest is. Then the end of the Fourth Age really is marked when the rune essence is rediscovered and humans, namely, regain their access to magic. And it aids in them regaining a sense of dominance and leading to the Fifth Age, which is kind of the age of humans, really.
And the age that most of RuneScape is set in. And
yes.
You know,
year 169.
Year 169. So I don't know that we're going to go too much to the Fifth Age, but we do have a few bullet points, I think, mm-hmm. to talk about of main things to happen there, including a couple big ones.
Yeah, I mean, humans, as I said, they get their runes and they subdue the other races that are around. They grow significantly. We have Kandaren, which was overrun by other forces, is purged by the Ceridominists, and Ardoin is found, as well as the kingdom of Kandaren itself. So named Delrith comes the first time and is slain. The Imkando dwarves become extinct, essentially, except for Thurgo and a few others. Big thing is the schism in the First Wizard's Tower between the Zamorakians and the rest of the orders causes the burning of the First Wizard's Tower. It's originally blamed on the Zamorakians, and we think it's all the Zamorakians, but the quest we get with Ariane kind of shed a different light upon that and show us that it's really kind of everybody's fault. Once it's rebuilt, Zamorakians are banished from study at the Wizard's Tower.
And you know, this was also kind of forced into RuneScape lore at a later date, because when RS2 first came out, we basically just had Rune Mysteries, but this actual quest providing the background on the Wizard's Tower didn't arrive until something like 2015, I want to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we got the proper rework of the Wizard's Tower, and with it came some ooh new lore kind of thing. It was but okay, something that happened. On a silly note, King Arthur arrives in RuneScape from Britain, and he might return, but he's given a mansion. And yeah, that's I've not to go too much into my own opinions, I've never liked that King Arthur is in RuneScape.
Yeah, and see, you know, they are having major discussions about retconning that with the rework of Sears Village and that surrounding area, and replacing it with a more thematic quest.
And this is coming from a person who is absolutely in love with Arthurian lore and loves the legend itself. I just don't think it fits. They brought it in at a time where they didn't really quite have an idea fully of the lore that they wanted for the world that they were creating, and thus I understand why it was introduced, but I think it's due for a retcon. I don't think it's wrong to take it away.
Yeah, it's not major and it doesn't go anywhere except the standard spell book for chivalry and piety do come from a quest following that. So
that's true.
But that's minor. Minor in the grand scheme of things.
In Ardoin, we have the split because King Ulthus dies, and then Tiras and Lathis split the two into West and East Ardoin. Elvarg is awoken in the volcano on Crandor by Crandorians. I don't know how many people were able to live on Crandor, given how small it is, but he's awoken, and they are summarily attacked, and the island pretty much destroyed. The three wizards with the map, Melzar, and the other two, basically take off and split the map between the three, and thus we have the setup for Dragonslayer. And probably the biggest thing, we have the White Knights, Temple Knights, and Kintra doing their whole thing. Draken is eventually killed, but one of the biggest happenings of the Fifth Age is Lucien's story. And Lucien stealing the Staff of Armadil and gaining access to the stone with the help of Movario. And this sets up quests like Wal'gothic Sleeps, Ritual of the Majrap, arguably the most influential. And in my opinion, these quests cause such a shift, a tonal shift, in how quests were to be done with RuneScape and how lore was to be dealt with. Not only was lore something to be, and quests were to be something that were silly and were fun, which I totally love. I've written about that ad nauseum, that I am all for lighthearted quests, but they shifted to a point where lore was really taken seriously, and there were some epic storylines that began to be written. And in my opinion, Wal'gothic Sleeps, I would argue the Desert Treasure was probably the beginning of that, but the culmination of which being Wal'gothic Sleeps and Ritual of the Majrap.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with you there. And, you know, we even talked about this a number of weeks ago back in November on the podcast, for those of you guys listening back then. There was the Abbey Road competition, and, you know, talking about what people's favorite RuneScape music tracks are. And I personally don't think there's anything more iconic than Temple Desecrated.
I was just about to say that. Temple Desecrated. And then I would... if I had to go with a second, I do Memories of Guthix, just because, in my opinion, that was also an extremely influential quest, whether that's for good or ill, in the opinions of many. Those were not only iconic quests, but also just fantastic pieces introduced into the track.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, it's also speaking of prominent figures, Lucien has to be the biggest of the Fifth Age, probably. In all of his various forms, and, you know, his link to the Majrap, it's just there. And you can't get through the Fifth Age, and you can't get through modern RuneScape quests without coming across that. Granted, we all like the elf story and, you know, the fake plague and whatnot. But once again, that is relatively minor in the grand scheme of things.
Because in reality, the actions of Lucien are what spark the Sixth Age beginning, because Lucien stealing the staff and being killed by the Dragon King.
The staff was stolen in... Which quest is the staff?
Temple of Ikov.
Temple of Ikov. There we go. I wanted to say there was an intermediate one between Ikov and Wal'gothic Sleeps, but I can't remember that far back.
Yeah, I think it's
Ikov. We'll go with Temple of Ikov.
If I'm wrong,
someone will correct us.
Mostly from my head here, and my memory. So he finds the stone and all that, and he's killed at the ritual, and then the Dragonkin take. I mean, that's such an iconic scene. Not only is the Lucien killing all of the lovely people. Hazelmere being named one of them.
In Wal'gothic Sleeps.
In the wilderness, yes, in Wal'gothic Sleeps. But then the Dragonkin in Ritual of the Majrap stabbing Lucien when they think they're going to, when he's going to ascend or something of that nature. It's another iconic scene. But soon after, even though the Dragonkin have it, Sliske is able to use the Shadow Realm to kind of trick the Dragonkin and steal the staff for himself. And of course, this eventually leads to The World Wakes, where Sliske lures the unsuspecting adventurer into a series of caverns in order to uncover where Guthix was sleeping and eventually to kill him with that stolen staff of Armadil.
Yeah,
thus ending the Fifth Age.
And at this point, when we were doing that quest, I think there was a question, you know, is Jagex jumping the shark with this quest line? Is this too much? You know, I think it didn't necessarily go as absurd as it could have gone. So I think in regards to that was good. But at the same time, I know there's lots of questions out there about people about if the whole arc that we've seen so far was worth it.
Yeah.
In the Sixth Age.
There's a part in me that wants to say it was unwise and that it shouldn't have been done and that we should have remained in the Fifth Age and just kind of stayed there. But in reality, I feel like it was the natural progression of things because what more was there to be done without – I think that what we loved about While Guthix Sleeps and Ritual of the Majrat, what made those quests so exciting was not only the adventure and the mechanics that were involved in it, but the story about the gods and these creatures
that
were –
Because that was our first taste of it.
Yes, they were tempting – and kind of playing with these powers of a god. And it was this thing that we've never really seen before. And it kind of just, in my opinion, it naturally led to the situation where Sliske killed Guthix and the gods were brought back to RuneScape. I've discussed before how there have been some questionable choices with the Sliske storyline. And while I don't think it was handled perfectly, because it kind of got to a point where they had to do either kind of a Deus Ex kind of situation, or which in reality they did because the Elder Gods eventually stepped in.
Yeah.
But now I really don't know where they will go from there, but.
Oh, I have an answer for you.
You do. I am very interested in hearing that then.
Okay. So we're in the Sixth Age now, and we'll talk about the ramifications of that in particular. But you know, there was a lore Q&A actually not too long ago about this earlier in the week, and they said that the idea behind the Sixth Age and killing Guthix was to kick the world into a stage where the gods would be back on the forefront and the players would have involvement of that with world events, but they had two unforeseen side effects of this. One, they had anticipated Zamorak winning World Event 1. So that so that changed the storyline and progression that they They anticipated Zamorak was going to win, and they had that mapped out where they wanted to go. So they had to change things up a bit for when Ceridomen won. Then the second unforeseen side effect was actually with the with the second world event, believe it or not. They felt too many people were unfairly against Zamorak or Bandos in that event because he was just seen as the war god, and they felt
that Bandos' side.
I know because you paid attention to the storylines and whatnot that were announced before World Event 2, but they feel that a good number of people who were just playing the World Event were not aware of those recent Bando story-based things that were in play there. So that was their second thing that they wish they could have done different with the Sixth Age. And the third thing is that the Tuska event kind of turned out to be
it was rigged.
Be a bit of a dud because they actually did have a plan that if the players were to lose against Tuska, large areas of the game map would have actually have been changed. So they still claim that it wasn't rigged, but
I don't believe it. I don't believe a single bit of it. To change RuneScape like that for such a seemingly like, I don't know, it just didn't seem to have the weight that they trumped it up to have it. They really made it seem as though it would be so big, but it really had no.
They said it would have been
up to
it would have been in a state of decay rather than you know just having areas wiped out. It would have been a state of decay like the Gobi homeworld.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they were really playing with something, an area that they'd never really dealt with before. And so they took some risks, which I totally commend. And I do not fault them for most of the decisions that were made, because it was a game becoming more and more ambitious with its storytelling. Much of it was good, I feel. But there were some definite areas where they slipped up, and I feel like they've learned from that. And I think I trust them once they start pumping out quests again, to put out good cohesive stories.
Indeed. So now a bit into the Sixth Age. So let's just go over a bit of what happened when that started.
Yeah. I mean, just to quickly go through it. Once Guthix dies, edicts are broken, gods can come back. That's the start of the Sixth Age, at the end of The World Wakes. Kind of the first to return that we really see are Ceridome and Zamorak, as we just mentioned. The Battle of Lumbridge ensues.
Right,
where
and that's
Zamorak
what I was
is,
just chatting about.
Yes, is defeated, and he is demoted to a Tier 4 god. And then, of course, as we were speaking about World Event 2, Armadil and Bandos are put against one another. Bandos is killed. Not just defeated, he is completely killed. His head is removed from the rest of his body. A big, big, big event, Fate of the Gods, is that the World Guardian helps bring back Zaros, who has been incorporeal all this time and waning in power. He finally has the chance to come back. And the World Guardian, whether for strong or for weak, gives Zaros a new form.
And, you know, this is something that has been going on for a long time and players have wanted since Desert Treasure, really, and before. It wasn't known what Zaros would be, and I think everyone was a little bit surprised in the actual form that was taken.
Yes, Azanandra and his whole storyline really leads up to this. And Temple at Sintistan, and you were talking about Desert Treasure, Dig Site, all those quests really lead up to the return of Zaros in the Sixth Age with the help of the Adventurer. And it's I absolutely love that quest still, because the world that they created with Frenis Grey, even though it wasn't a huge world, it was still, at least I felt, relatively interactive, and there was an element of danger, and I just absolutely love that quest. But in other news, Prif Dinis was sung back into existence after the Dark Lord was finally defeated once again by the World Guardian. V comes back, a god hailed by the Fremenic peoples, and is unceremoniously slaughtered by the Dragonkin. And what we thought would be a
Fremenic
quest.
Right, we thought that was a Fremenic quest, but it was a Dragonkin quest.
Yeah, that was one area where I thought they kind of foot in mouth, but oh well. They tried. Black Knights with the Falador event attempt and fail to retake take Falador, rather. We find the old tutorial island and explore it, understand its curse, I guess, which again was kind of a frustrating quest. We won't delve into that. And then Sliskay, kind of the pinnacle of thus far the Sixth Age, pits all the gods against one another. With his scoreboard and his quote-unquote grand ascension. And in the end, Stone is destroyed, Fliskay is killed, and we are introduced to the waking up Elder Gods.
Now, the thing that is something that I think could have been perhaps done a little bit better with this, and I spoke about this when it was time on the actual episode when it was out in game. The scoreboard was there. It was updated, but nothing really came from that. And maybe something will come from that when we get replayability of Sliskay's endgame, but we haven't got that yet. That, as far as we know, is still in the QA phase. It was a passion project for Mod Raven. So
yeah. And this is Sliskay's storyline. It's where I felt like it started off so promisingly. Missing Presumed Death is in, if not the top 5, top 10 of all time quests out of the 213, I think, or however many, because it's just so well done graphically, story wise, everything. They set up the story so beautifully, and it just kind of fizzled. in my opinion. I think they rushed it. The attempt to complete the storyline in a timely fashion prevented it from really evolving and developing any sense of weight.
Yeah.
Which is one thing that the ElfQuest line did probably too much of. Right. So
and you
it's
know,
finding that balance.
There's a level of bias also here that could be the case because Endgame itself was a long quest. It was it had lots of
review at
and the episode that made us pull our hair out 2 days before Christmas last year.
Yeah.
There were issues with the quest. We wanted to read the lore, but we were kicked out by anomalies or whatever was attacking us in the maze. And you get to the end of that quest and you're asking ourselves, we're all asking ourselves these questions. Yeah. Why did this ending just happen? What decisions did I make to have the final race in this quest being a race between me and Armadale for the stone? Is that who you had?
Yes, that's who I had, and I had no way of possibly defeating him. It was because, I don't want to get into it. It was a frustrating end.
And that is something we'll be able to get clarity of when the replayability of Endgame comes out, because we will be able to modify the decisions that we made along the way.
Soon, TM. Soon.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually thinking of doing a reunion episode on when that update comes out.
That wouldn't be something I'd be opposed to.
Because there's just so many unanswered questions with that.
Yeah, and a lot of loose threads from that.
Right, and that's exactly where we're hanging right now. And this also goes back to the Q&A from this week, because they said, what's next? And they said, we want to go with the Elder God storyline. But we want to have a bit of a break on the amount of epic quests that we're bringing you. We want to take that number down, because I think last year, you know, every quest was a storyline ender, so to speak, if I recall correctly, in 2016, not 2017. And they want to get back to the more bottle quest type quests with, you know, that kind of mid to short to mid long length, kind of like we had with the Evil Dave quest. That's what they want to get back to.
And trust me, I love those quests.
Oh yeah, definitely, because that is what made every storyline up until we said that you practically got to well, Gothic Sleeps. So and you know, that makes sense, I guess.
But let me ask this, not to dive too deep into a rabbit hole here. What, because we asked this question of Sliske, and the scale was even smaller, even though it seemed very large, it was very large. What is the result of, what will be the end game of the Elder Gods questline, and where do you go after that's over?
Right, and that's the big question. For
me, go nowhere but down. Yes. That's the thing. We've continually escalated and escalated and escalated and escalated, and it was fun on the ride up. But is it going to be fun coming back down once we eventually have to?
Because we have just determined that our goal is to prevent the Elder Gods from destroying the world and the universe that was created.
Unless it's just some eternal struggle that we are eternally locked in, I just don't see much of a way around. Just kind of another kind of, oh, it's,
you know,
over.
This would have been a great question to ask at RuneFest this year in the lore Q&A.
Yeah, well, I was a bit indisposed.
Yeah, I'm going to send this one along next year to people who are there if they're doing a lore Q&A. Because, you know, that's a very key point. Where do you go after you're dealing with the Elder Gods who create the matter of the universe?
Yeah, it seems like you can go nowhere else but down. Which, again, I'm not trying to say that the smaller quests are a bad thing, but once you create a desire within the player base to get this bigger and bigger and bigger, bigger scale of story, it might seem strange for the adventurer who has just defeated the Elder Gods, the creators of the universe, to then go and deal with some pigs by a crazy farmer. Like, it just seems kind of strange, you know?
But yeah. And, you know, maybe it's good that we're taking this break then, and we don't need to cross that bridge right now. And who knows? It could be another 10 years before we get to that point, just like it took that long for the Elf series to wrap up.
Yeah, for sure. So.
All right.
For sure.
Anything else, Six Age, before we wrap for this episode?
I mean, not really. Scour Quest takes place in the Sixth Age. That's also my top 10. Absolutely loved Scour Quest. It made me smile and laugh throughout.
Yeah, what's the word I'm looking for? Some kind of love letter.
Momentous, cathartic, like a swan song or.
Yeah, something to the fans like that. So.
Yeah. It was fan service, the quest. I'll say that.
And that one is replayable right now.
Yes.
So.
Good stuff. But.
All right.
Yeah, that's about all I have to say. Here we are.
It's interesting how, you know, we have the period of calm and then things just start ramping up again. Like you said, maybe this is why Jagex wanted Zamorak to win, because Zamorak, of course, we saw this in Dishonor Among Thieves. It's not so much war. It's preventing stagnation through chaos and ensuring that what's going forward will be viable. And if Jagex could have done that, they could have gone with some more interesting storylines, perhaps. So
certainly could have.
Very interesting. And see, that nugget just came out a few days ago. So that they were planning on him winning.
Wow. Yeah, I had not heard that until just now.
Yeah, it certainly puts things in a different perspective, doesn't it?
Certainly, certainly.
All righty, folks. Well, there's your lore recap. RuneScape from the beginning, starting with cosmology and working our way all the way up to the Sixth Age and everywhere in between. So we're going to wrap this episode up with a pick of the week that Colton has. So what do you got?
Now, to put you all in the Christmas mood, I would like to direct you all to the greatest of all Christmas albums ever composed. It is The Christmas Song by Nat King Cole, the late, great Nat King Cole. It is amazing. My wife is over here laughing at me because she knows I love this album far too much. Part of it, obviously, is my connection to childhood. And I am biased because this was the album that my parents always put on as we were opening presents Christmas morn. And it was just, there are a lot of memories that are associated with it. It's just a classic, clean album. Nat King Cole has just an amazing voice. If you've never really listened to his stuff before, his stuff other than his Christmas stuff is amazing. But I think that's what he's best known for. And other than a few select other songs in the more wide sweeping culture. But The Christmas Song, his rendition of O Tannenbaum, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, O Come All Ye Faithful, O Little Town of Bethlehem, all of them, O Holy Night, they're just great works of, it's art and it's beautiful and I love it and it's wholesome and it's pure and it's Christmas and I love it. So please listen to it.
It's the awesome. Original in many cases for this.
Yes. So.
And that's correct. Where, of course, all the derivatives have come from that have become popular in years. And, of course, when you go back to, I believe this goes back to the 1940s, that kind of puts things in perspective to this and the fact it's still popular today. So
yes.
Thank you for that, Colton. Looks like it's findable on Spotify, iTunes Music, Apple Music, pretty much anywhere you can get music these days. So shouldn't be too hard to find. So. All right, so what have you been up to, RuneScape or otherwise?
Unfortunately, I just finished the RuneScape quest, the RuneScape this year's Christmas event, finding Santa and the whole genome project culmination. Very much enjoyed that. Haven't had much time, unfortunately. Well, it's not so much time; it's connection, which we've struggled with this evening, but. Other than grappling with that, that should be solved here in a matter of a few months, thankfully. And hopefully we'll get back into the swing of things. But yeah, and when I get back into it, I need to get back my Master Quest cape because I missed that very much.
All right. Just two quick little things then. What did you think of the Christmas quest? Where does it rate in terms of past quests, past Christmas quests?
Greatest in quite a while. I loved the probably the one that I remember most recently that I enjoyed almost as much as this one was the one in which Santa was captured by a demon in Lumbridge Crater. I did enjoy that one. And we had that was the first time that Lumbridge Crater was really used for anything of note. And we used it for the Christmas event that year. And I thought it was a great idea. And I enjoyed that one, but it was an awesome Christmas quest. I mean, it felt very just classic Christmas, finding Santa and then finding all these different ways to put together, and make, what was his name again? It had some robotic name.
Who are you
referring to? The actual gnome itself. The gnome.
Doggone it. Yeah, that's interesting. I can't remember that.
Anyhow.
That was last week's episode of RSB and the Update.
Yeah. Listen to that if you really want that. I'm obviously not here for that. But no, I enjoyed it. If not 9, then 10 out of 10.
All right. And second thing from that, thank you for being here, Colton. And
of course.
Hopefully this will go down as one of the best episodes of RSBNB Update ever, because I do – I have wanted to do this for a long time, and we finally sat down and had the time to do it and do it properly to justice. So thank you for that.
We did the dang thing. We did the dang thing.
That's right.
And
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that I absolutely appreciate the invite, dealing with my somewhat tenuous connection. It was great to be back on. It's been too long.
Indeed, it has. Just a bit of an update from myself. It's only been a few days since I spoke from the podcasting sense, because we're doing this very early in the week, but I spent a bit of time on the weekend, a couple hours on the weekend doing Livid Farm. Don't tell anyone that. I hate that activity, but it was Livid Farm Heresy. Weekend, so I did it. I did it. I did a bit of it, and it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad. They have that, believe it or not. They have the cost on all the spells.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. So. I'll have to look into that maybe. The thing is that the only reason I would really do those is to get the comp cape, and I don't want the comp cape unless they make it a master quest requirement.
Yeah. And that's really a whole other topic for itself we've been having throughout the year, but anyways.
Yeah.
Well, with that being said, thank you for joining us, everyone, for this podcast and listening. Colton, again, thank you for being here and doing this with us. It was great. We will be back next week for the clip show, the 2017 clip show of RSBNB Update. I thought I had all the clips compiled, but something during this episode changed, and you'll be hearing from that,
part of that
on the clip show.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
I look forward to that.
So with that being said, Merry Christmas, everyone. See you next week for the clip show.
Merry Christmas and farewell.